Hello and welcome back to the Not So Fit Couple podcast with your hosts, Lucy Davis.
And Benjamin Holden. So this week's episode is kindly sponsored by Air Up. Since we introduced these on the podcast, I think it was last week or the week before.
Yeah, I think it's 2 weeks
we've
ago.
Had quite a lot of questions about like what they are. Essentially, they are a refillable bottle which turns plain water and sparkling water into flavoured water for a scent.
If you're watching on YouTube, you can basically see the bottles that me and Ben have, and they're 650ml, which I think is actually probably more ideal than carrying a litre bottle. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It's a bit more hand friendly. And if you can see, by the way, if you're not on YouTube, definitely flick over so you can actually see what I'm showing you. You have these little tabs that you put on top. So mine is raspberry straw, so basically mixed berries. When you sip it, you smell the tab. So it uses different senses rather than just like taste, if that makes sense.
I'm super terrible getting water in because I hate drinking water.
You do hate it.
I don't think it tastes like anything at all. So these ones are actually great because when I take them to the gym, when I'm just like, nah, I don't want to drink water, I'll just have a sip of these.
Do you want to try mine?
No, I like mine. It's better.
Can I have a little taste?
That one's the lychee.
Wow, that smells so strong,
that one, isn't it? So that's what I mean. So, you know, sometimes when you're ill and you've got a cold and stuff, you can't often taste foods. And that's because your scent plays a massive part.
Wow, that was really nice.
Your taste. So that's the same thing with this. The scent effectively alters the taste of the water because there's no additives or anything like that in it to change the flavor.
And then also, you basically have a reusable bottle.
Yeah.
So you're not using shit tons of plastic.
Well, each pod needs 25 to 50 times less plastic per litre than the usual bottled beverages do. So if you want to try and be more sustainable and lower your carbon footprint, is it? And this is a great way to do so. And the bottles look super cool as well.
They do look super cool. They match our set. Look at that. I think that looks literally so bougie. But we have a link or a code?
Yeah, so the link will be in the YouTube video. And the link will be in the podcast description, and you can save 10% with the code NOTSOFIT.
NOTSOFIT. Lovely. Okay, so today's podcast, and
firstly, we have been today talking about different guests that we can potentially get on the podcast.
Yes.
If you have any guests you'd love to see on the podcast, any recommendations, please feel free to drop them on the YouTube video comments. Even if you don't watch on the YouTube video and there's someone you think, I'd love to hear them on the podcast, jump over on the YouTube, drop a comment on there of a guest, and we will do our best to reach out and try and get them on.
Yeah, doesn't matter who it is. It could be Elon Musk. We'll do our best to get him on the podcast. But today's episode, we're talking about numerous topics that are a little bit more fitness focused today. Obviously, myself and Ben are in the fitness industry, and we always think these episodes are like one of our favorites, and they're super helpful for people.
Yeah, because I think the direct questions from listeners, so it's massively helpful for us to answer them because it gives you direct feedback from us.
Yeah, 100%. Shall I go first?
No, rock, paper, scissors.
Okay. Oh, no. Okay. So wait, go. One,
three, two.
No, wait, this is an example. One, two, three, and then
go.
Yeah.
Okay. Say go.
Okay.
One, two, three, go.
Yes. It's the most exciting thing when I win. Did you ever do it in primary school where it was like water bomb?
No,
fireball.
You can't make shit up. It's not fucking Pokemon.
Yeah, but I mean, I still won either way. Okay, so I'll go first with my first question.
Go.
The first question is, and it's a very just small, simple question. Tips for beginner lifters or a beginner to lifting?
So I always like to answer these with analogies.
You love an analogy.
And the one that I always use is to do with swimming, because most people have taken swimming lessons and can relate. So when you first start taking swimming lessons, you will never go and jump in the deep end first. You'll always go in the paddle end first, dip your toes in, get in the shallow end, learn the basics of how to swim before you then go into the deeper depths of the water to explore. Exactly the same with the gym. You don't need to start doing everything at once. You don't need to be going to the gym 5 days a week. You don't need to be tracking every single little element of lifting. You don't need to be doing these circus acts of wonderful shit that people are posting online.
Yeah.
Because the one thing to remember is that when you're new to the gym is you are like when you're a horny teenager and you have sex for the first time, like whatever you do just feels great. It's exactly the same when you first start going to the gym because you are hyper responsive to a lot of training.
Mm-hmm. You got
those
gains.
You got those newbie gains. So whatever you do essentially in that first couple of weeks, couple of months, you're going to grow from, you're going to develop from, you're going to progress from. So I would say for a lot of time, it's about trial and error. Mm-hmm. However, that isn't the only thing, because obviously one of the big things to avoid wasting time as you develop and go through could be to pick up a program, because starting on a basic program might even help you pull back on the amount of volume that you're going to do. Because mm-hmm. I always believe that you should get more bang for your buck and try and do less to get more.
Yeah, 100%. You basically, it's like you could read my show notes. I was saying that it's so important not to go balls to the wall straight away. As in, as you said, you don't need to do 5-6 sessions straight away just because you've seen other people online doing it. And one of the most important things is, as Ben said, the basic staple exercises do work. And there are a lot of people who come over to the My Coach School app who are beginners, and we feel we're helping them unlearn things that they've picked up from other people, other trainers, social media. I'm not naming names, but people who have been doing 7 HIIT sessions a week and their knees and their joints are absolutely screwed, or they're doing these crazy ass exercises and it's a bit off-putting. So they come over to the school and we unlearn what they have learned. And one of the most important things is actually following a program. I wish when I started training, like going to the gym, that I had an actual program to follow, because my glute workouts, for example, I spoke about this before on the podcast, I used to go in and feel the need to do like 11 glute exercises. And I was frustrated because I was like, why aren't I seeing any growth? Why aren't I seeing any progression? That just doesn't work. I now do like 4 or 5 glute exercises because I know that works. The basic staple exercises, progressively overloading and learning those things over time. But I didn't have that. Mm. I didn't know who to look up to or what to do. So I just used to piece together loads and loads of stuff and do ridiculous amounts of volume. So it's obviously saying to, if you are a beginner, you don't need to be doing 11 exercises, 12 exercises. You could do 4 or 5. They could be all super basic, 4 sets of 8, just going in there, following a program that you can stay accountable to and something that you actually enjoy. I think quite a big one is the whole enjoyment element, that you have to enjoy what you're doing. Like as a beginner, you shouldn't already be forcing yourself to train. You should want to go to the gym or want to run or cycle or Zwift or whatever you're doing.
What I've been doing isn't it Zwift at the moment.
Zwift.
So that's really been that's really been humbling for me, because I'm very new to cycling and I was doing a beginner program yesterday. I had to stop after 10 minutes because I was fucked. I couldn't keep up with the group that I was cycling with. And that's, again, even with programs, it can be very humbling when you start something and to know where your level of ability is before you even go into it. I think one of the other things that a lot of people do is, as beginners, is we look at people for motivation online, or we look at people of influence who look awesome, and then we go, okay, what are they doing in the gym? I'll just copy because then I'll look like that. Which, what you've got to remember is that person's probably got 10 years training experience. They've been training for a very long time, so their body is used to that load, that volume, that intensity, whereas you're not. So simply copying someone isn't the right thing to do. Also, like I was thinking when I was in the gym this morning training legs, I train nowhere near as hard or as long as I used to. Nowhere near.
6-hour leg workout.
Like, even just with, just not even that bit, even just with legs, I don't train as hard because I train smarter rather than harder.
Yeah.
And that's why I was a big fan of slow and steady, not hard and heavy. So
slow and steady, not hard and heavy. That's a well good quote.
So try and apply that to training, because one of the big mistakes that I made when I was a beginner, and I've told this story before on the podcast, is Saturday for me was a day where it was gym day. Not just gym session, gym day. Honestly, it was a gym day. Proper,
I remember you telling
proper
me.
Bro shit. So I'd go to the old school gym that I used to train at with my mate about 10 o'clock. We'd train 10 till 12. Way too long for a session anyway, 2 hours. Mm. And then we'd go around the corner to the Asda. Go to the Asda. Get just a whole fucking chicken. What's your favourite chicken from Asda flavour?
I like barbecue.
Yeah, I usually used to get
I don't buy a whole barbecue chicken. I buy, like, if I was going to get barbecue chicken, it'd be the packs of chicken.
Because you're not a fucking savage bro like
not
I was.
Nando's.
So I was a chicken assassin, so I used to buy one of those, full one, with a 1.5 litre of strawberry milkshake, nail that in, let it digest for about an hour, and then go back in the gym for, like, another 3 hours. And we'd just do laps of the gym, cycling through the equipment and the machine, just playing with them. And obviously that was cheaper because it's like 5 or 6 hours worth of training there as a teenager. And obviously my body could take it because when you're 16 to 18, you can just do anything. You're literally Superman. So I just recover from it, and that's all I used to do. Just wasting loads of time. That's why I'm a big fan of getting more bang for your buck of your training. Not doing too much when you first start, and then slowly scaling your training as you're going through.
Yeah, I think actually that's a really good point. Some beginners look at, like, the gym environment or training, and they think they're going to be in there for like 3 hours. Yeah. My session this morning was a glute workout, and it was 50 minutes. And it was a full banging glute session from the app, and I absolutely loved it. And it took me 50 minutes. Even when I first started going to gym, I'd be in there for at least... When I started gym, hour and a half, hour 45, just keep going, just keep going, just keep going. But yeah, that's actually a really good point to tell if you are a beginner who's listening. Don't think you have to be in the gym for even over an hour and a half. Obviously, maybe if you're doing strength training, but like 2 hours, you're really pushing the ball out there.
The other big thing for me with beginner training is that when you first start doing anything new, doesn't matter whether it's the gym, whether it's driving a car, whether it's a new work environment, you're always going to have lower confidence, because as human beings, whenever we step out of our comfort zone and do something different in a different environment with different habits, we're always going to feel less confident doing it, because we've never built up those mental calluses to gain experience that we're more confident in those situations, because through repetition, we become more confident at doing stuff.
Yeah.
And I put this tweet up the other day. And again, it wasn't direct at this type of person, to either newbie, but I think you can take a lot from it, because there's a lot of people who are self-conscious going to the gym based on their sort of perception of what other people think.
Mm.
So just think about this. Being at peace with the fact that some people will like you and some won't will never sit easy with you. But the moment that you come to terms with this is where you will level up you and your impact. Nobody can be you.
It's really great. I love that. It's
so
nice.
I think when you start to remember that in your life, not every single person is going to like you no matter what you do.
Yeah, you can't be.
That is when you will start to do the shit that you want to do, and it will stop you from pulling you back.
Yeah. I think it's a hard lesson to learn, but it's definitely one
difficult.
That if you can pick it
so
up right away,
so
like,
difficult.
Definitely do it. Okay.
My question.
You go, my go.
How important are deload weeks?
Okay, so I am very for deload weeks. Shall I explain what a deload week is?
Explain what deload is first, yeah.
So a deload week is essentially where it's usually a week, which is why it's called a deload week, where you reduce the load, the intensity, the volume of your workouts and of your sessions that week. And it's basically recharge, relax, kind of reset your central nervous system, get rid of ridiculous amounts of soreness that you might be having, or if you're in a fatigue plateau, whatever it would be. And deload weeks are something that I've pretty much always done. And I don't know, that's because I've come from a swimming background where we used to have tapers, I think a taper is a bit dissimilar to a deload, because obviously a taper is more of a sporting term. Like
what is a taper?
So a taper is basically the same thing, where you reduce the intensity, the volume, but you also take off the amount of sessions. So I have a taper.
So is that like periodization then?
Yeah, but I have a taper before my ultra that's in my program, where I'm doing way less running. I'm not doing any strength sessions that week to prepare myself for a specific event. It must be that. I think you taper before, we used to taper before like champs or...
Yeah, yeah. Because you don't go balls to the wall before like a game day.
Yeah. Maybe like footballs would do it. I don't even know. But yeah, I really like deload weeks, and it's something that I have definitely done in my training and my programming.
So in my opinion, deload weeks are great. But unless you are in a strength-based program or cycle, you don't need to schedule them.
Schedule is in like you don't.
So you don't
explain.
You don't necessarily. For example, if we look at most gyms in the UK, most people stop looking there. It's weird.
I didn't know if it was like it had like taste. Just smile.
Isn't it being weird? So anyway, when you look at most gyms in the UK, most people aren't doing strength-based programs or performance-based programs in the general gym. Most people are general gym goers who aren't training at the necessary intensity to need to schedule in a deload, because the deloads will usually come in when they go on holidays through the year, when they take trips away, when they take a week, unplanned week off, when they get ill or sick. So they're kind of like the deloads. The other way to also use a deload, and this is more so how I use them at the moment, because I'm not doing a program which is based on structure of strength and percentages to where I'm really, really building up. Because a lot of the time I'll keep reps in reserve and training to build tissue and not necessarily for performance, which requires heavy numbers or low numbers where I'm having a lot of impact on the central nervous system and the joints. So I will take my deloads based on how I feel. So when I'm looking at how I feel, I'm looking at where is my strength currently at? Has it fell through the floor? Can I recover? I.e., if you are one of these people who's like, I'm just sore all the time, I'm not recovering and super fatigued, then potentially take a deload. Mm. If you're picking up a lot of injuries or niggles, like for example, for me at the moment, I've got a bicep niggle and a hamstring niggle, I'll deload those areas because I can't train them properly at the moment. So it's just about being more in tune and self-aware of your body sometimes for me with deload. However, with deloads for strength programs, so for example, there's one or two programs on the school that are based on 5-3-1, which is essentially strength-based programs which cycle through different percentages. And the fourth week is a deload because that essentially is like a taper week where you need to take away some of the training volume because you're about to go in the week after and do a test of your 1RM.
Yeah.
And you, even if you don't feel like, or energy-wise, feel great, because I've had it with clients sometimes where they've been like, I don't need a deload. You fucking do, mate.
Yeah, you're absolutely fucked.
You need a deload because it's going to help your joint, your central nervous system be ready for that following week.
Yeah.
You're not going to lose anything. Just because you're working at 50% of the volume or intensity, you're not going to lose anything. You're going to keep the engine ticking along and we're still going to be practicing technique and form. But you need that deload scheduled in at that point. What I'm saying is the majority of people don't require deload weeks because they don't put in enough intensity to need them. However, there's going to be some people who, you know, the type of people, and you know, if you're listening, if you're this type of person who is like trained every single day, will never take a day off because they're almost obsessed with training. That type of person may also need a deload, or it might be quite mentally difficult to take one.
Yeah.
That's where, for that type of person, telling someone to take a week off is fucking not happening. So having a deload week may be more advantageous to that type of person because psychologically and mentally and habitually they'll still stay in routine.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I forgot to mention before, and this is kind of relevant to the question you asked me and the question that I had for beginners in terms of, so the program that Ben was talking about there is the strength program on the My Coach School app. And it's one of the programs that I had wrote, I think we've had that about a year now or just less. And week 4 and week 8 are scheduled deload weeks because week 5 and 10 is testing your 1 rep max. And if you do want to try the My Coach School app, so if you're a beginner, absolutely fantastic. And I will big the app up because it is amazing. It truly is. We're one of the only fitness apps where we have taken the time to record the exercises, not in a studio. Like, we've not put a leg press in the studio and just doing an exercise. We talk through every single exercise. So for a beginner, you can imagine how advantageous that is to actually be able to hear us being like, hip hinge.
Yeah.
Hip hinge is this. Imagine there's a door behind you or whatever it is. So if you want a 7-day free trial on the My Coach School app, just use the code NOTSOFIT20. And then you can just try it out. If you don't like it, won't be offended.
Link is in the description of the YouTube video and the podcast.
Yeah.
With that as well, is I think once you try some of the programs, you'll realize you don't actually have to do a ton of exercises, or you don't have to be in the gym for ages when you go through some mine and Lucy's programs. And even I had a question the other day in the Facebook group, which was, oh, why have I only got 2 sets of this exercise? And that's because you don't need to be doing 4 sets of every single exercise all the time, especially with some of my programs, which are geared off for you to go full out on 2 sets. Because if you go balls to the wall on 2 sets, you don't need to do 4.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be goosed.
Shouldn't be able to do 4.
You're going to be Donald Ducked from it. So that is why some of my programs only have 2 sets of each exercise.
Okay.
Again, back to me when taking deloads. I've just been saying to Carlos more in the gym, like I've got like little injuries at the moment, niggles, biceps sore, hamstring sore. I haven't taken a week off for a while. However, we go on holiday in 3 weeks.
Less than 3 weeks.
For 16 days.
20 and days.
When we go away, I'm training-wise pretty much going to be taking a deload because I'm almost going to be doing one-on, one-off. Sessions in the gym will probably be about 30 minutes before just getting a quick session in the morning. Or hopefully I'll be back with my running by that point in my hamstring better. And I'll be doing 10K or less. So for me, it's a kind of forced deload, but in a very nice environment.
Yeah. What's a food?
Vitamin D.
Vitamin D, Disney, Universal, Harry Potter. It's all very exciting. Shit. Okay, my next question. How can I lose weight if my deficit isn't working?
Well, you're not on a deficit.
Yeah. It's kind of a harsh reality, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like the way that question is worded, how can I lose weight if my deficit isn't working?
You can't be in a deficit if it's not, if you're not losing weight, you're not in a deficit. It's the ins and outs of it.
Mm-hmm.
There may be reasons of why you're slipping out of that deficit. Maybe if you are having a lot of condiments, they could be sliding into your diet to bring you up to maintenance. A big one is always people's weekends.
Yeah.
So I, for a lot of clients, will put in days of intuitive eating on a Saturday, but I very clearly explain they're not a day of binging or just eating all out whatever you want, because it's very then easy to take you out of that deficit that you created through the week by just going and tanking your ass on a weekend. Mm. So especially the type of person on Saturday and Sunday, you don't give a fuck and you're like, oh, I can get away with it because I've done it for 5 days. It's not the case. You can eat a bit more on the weekend if you're more restrictive through the week and create that flexibility for yourself on the weekend. But a lot of people overdo the weekends to the point which takes them out of the deficit for the week, and essentially you just sabotaged the 5 days of hard work you put in through the week. I know it's difficult sometimes to stick to it. I know it's difficult to lose weight, but you don't have to stick in that period of being in a deficit forever. It's a little bit like saving for a house, saving for a mortgage. You don't have to scrape it away and save away all of your life. You do it for a big period to put that down payment down. Mm-hmm. And once you're there, it's then a lot easier to maintain.
Yeah, 100%. And I think what you said there was really important in terms of snacking, condiments, Starbucks. For example, you have the best example of the Starbucks mic.
Yeah. I put my nose on
it. Ben's put his nose on the mic. That was so funny. The Starbucks scenario. Can I tell the story?
Yeah.
So Ben had a client and he was in a calorie deficit. They were on a personal weight loss journey and they kind of just hit like a significant plateau and weight was kind of going up, plateauing rather than like dropping about a pound to 2 pounds a week. And then Ben was like, are you kind of like, are you doing something that you're not really tracking, like going out having a coffee? And was he having two or three of these?
Three a day. So he'd have one at breakfast, one at lunch, and one on his way home.
Yeah. And it was a caramel large macchiato from Starbucks. They're pushing on 400, 500 calories.
They are 395, I think they were at the 395.
Okay. So we'll round it to 400. That is 1,200 calories extra per day.
For 5 days a week,
which is quick maths, no idea, a lot of calories. That's over like 7,000 calories.
6,000, I think it is.
And okay, so this example, how can I lose weight if my deficit isn't working? Are you having a large latte? I mean, even a large latte with full fat milk from Starbucks is like 200, 300 calories, which is that we actually spoke about this in the calories on menus thing like the other week. That for you personally might be beneficial to know. And maybe you'll go for a large black coffee with a drop of milk, and that's about 50 calories, because it's one of those things that you don't even think about tracking.
It's so easy to do, by the way, because look at fucking Pancake Gate for us.
Oh, my situation.
No, me.
Oh, that was a really. So we've both done that with pancakes.
That was only 6 weeks ago, and me and Lucy would like to consider ourselves experienced fitness experts. And me and Lucy, we weren't necessarily dieting at the time, but we just kind of like sticking in maintenance.
Yeah.
And we were making pancakes each night.
After Pancake Day, we got a bit.
Yeah,
obsessed,
we got obsessed with pancakes after Pancake Day, and we just went balls, didn't we? On the pancakes, like, oh, we'll have them every night. Me and Lucy tend to do this. We find the food like, we milk the shit out of it and hate it. So we had pancakes every night. And we were sort of roughly guesstimating what they were at. Little did I know the amount of calories in white flour.
Yeah.
White flour is...
We were putting in about 200 grams, weren't we?
Yeah.
So 200 grams of white flour.
No, it was 300 grams I put in.
Yeah, because we were kind of just guessing the ratios, but we did measure the flour. 300 grams of, of white flour is 1,092 calories. And then we were having 3 eggs, oat milk, and then toppings.
Yeah.
Ben was like, because I think I questioned you. I was like, I wonder how many calories. I mean, we weren't counting at times. I wonder how many calories are in these. And you're like, there's like 200
white
calories.
White flour is
flour.
One of those things that will just bend you over and stick you dry. Like, it doesn't care. It just doesn't care. But it's easy to go in. Yeah, it's easy to get in. That's what I mean by with a caloric deficit, you can think you're sticking to it. But there can be, even if you are being great and you're tracking, there can be things that you didn't even know were slipping into your diet or they were that high calories. Again, going back to that calories on menus debate, some people just wouldn't realize how much is in stuff and they're trying all week and they've got that one thing which is fucking them over every single week.
Yeah, I think so this is just to be a bit more play devil's advocate. If you categorically are sticking to your deficit, you're in a calorie deficit of maybe 300 calories and you're being diligent, you're not snacking, you're not having any condiments or Starbucks that you're not tracking, potentially your calories are way too low and you're barely moving. So your steps have slashed in half, you've no energy in the gym, you're not really expending the energy. And then also you might need a diet break. Like a planned diet break to basically take you out of a calorie deficit. And it's usually to break up longer periods of dieting. And it only needs to last like a week or 2 weeks. But that could be something that I would suggest. That's the only thing you could probably suggest.
You can't be in a deficit too long either, to the point where you won't lose weight. If you continue to be in a deficit for your whole life, you'd eventually die or wither away.
Yeah, your metabolic adaptation will just pop. But yeah, done.
So my next question is, and this one always comes up, by the way, and there's a couple new ones that I wanted to sort of touch on as well, so we don't have to go into every single one of them. Biggest fitness myths that are still around.
Ooh, okay. I actually did a post on this the other day, and I really enjoyed doing my post. I think sweating, so the myth, sweat equals fat loss.
Yeah.
Or sweat equals weight loss. Where sweating is a normal bodily function that should be happening. You shouldn't try and not sweat. You know when people get those things which like stop sweat, like those pads and stuff?
Never seen them. What are
they? Like stickers.
What?
They can put on your armpits and it stops your sweat glands.
Like fucking plasters?
Yeah, it stops you from sweating.
I'm sure that comes off though when you sweat.
No, it doesn't. It's a sweat thing, whatever. People.
No, wait there. What do you mean a sweat thing?
That's what it is. Like a sweat sticker. I don't know what it's called. Okay.
What are those things
buy,
that women
buy? The best underarm sweat pads, sweat block pads, sweat pads, sweat on clothing
so
labels.
So they're essentially like sanitary towels for underneath your armpits.
Yeah, it makes you stop sweating. So sweating is a natural human body function that happens when you get too hot and your temperature increases. And when you sweat, you lose electrolytes, you lose fluid that you actually should be replenishing. So when you do sweat during a workout or whatever you do, you should actually be drinking and replacing those electrolytes. Sweating, so say if you lost, you sweated loads and you lost weight, you've just lost water weight. You literally have not lost like any body fat. I think that's a really big myth because people started promoting these like sauna things, these hot, hot towels.
Lie down in your front room, man.
Yeah. Like, and then you can lose this amount of weight by sitting in a hot sauna. So I couldn't think of anything worse than just bathing in my own sweat and then just have to drink it all back anyway.
But that's why fighters do it. Fighters will do the hot therapy, hot and cold water therapy to lose the water. So then they'll step on the scales to hit the weight class. And then as soon as they've got off the scales, they're putting the water in. Stuff back in to get the weight back up again.
Yeah. I think maybe just one other one as well is cutting out carbohydrates equals instant weight loss. Yeah. I mean, cutting out carbs, yeah, you will see some sort of short-term weight loss.
Because your glycogen stores are depleted.
Your glycogen stores are depleted. You're going to feel like a floppy Asda bag. You're going to have no energy because you've basically taken away your main energy source and you're not going to be feeling that good. So if essentially you've cut out a whole food group, which you've probably put yourself into a deficit anyway. It's not because you specifically cut out carbs. You could have cut out protein or fats and you still would have probably lost weight because you've put yourself into a deficit by removing a whole food group anyway. So I do think that's a myth and I don't believe that ketogenic diet is very good. I think it's fucking shit.
Well, this is something that I've been looking at a little bit recently this morning, the ketogenic diet.
What to do it? We've got a situation.
Also to do with my IBS.
Feel like you can't have like avocado and like smoky bacon and
well, I had smoky bacon and eggs this morning for breakfast. So fuck you.
Can you can't have avocado though, can you? Which is like which is a keto fuel.
But the reason why is because carbohydrates are mainly the things that ferment the gut.
Gluten.
So I'm not doing a keto diet, but like I had a keto breakfast, if you want to say that, this morning. It's not really a keto breakfast. I had bacon and eggs, which is fucking great, by the way.
Yeah,
but you're... I'm just exploring stuff at the moment from IBS because it's just causing me absolute mayhem.
Yeah. Okay. Well, they were my two. I think those are the two.
Yeah,
that
I don't
instantly...
agree. I don't agree with the reason why people do ketogenic diet is because they are going to lose weight off it, because you could lose weight off any diet. There's hundreds of diets out there that will help you lose weight, which are a lot more sustainable and easy to stick to. But from like a health perspective, for example, we had Zach Bitter on. He actually started doing it because he had gut issues. So exactly the same. I think some people turn to it because it might help their digestion and issues that they have with their gut.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. One from me, following on from yours, was I think you don't have to be sore or sweaty for a good workout. A lot of people base workouts on being sore. I see the post on this yesterday on Instagram, which was looking at trainers who just drive people into the ground because they feel if they make a client sore the next day, then the client has got value for money.
Yeah, they think
it's
they're satisfied.
It's not what being a good PT is. You don't need to show up like sword and shithead going into combat and drive people into the ground to get people's money's worth. If you explain to people the why of why they're exercising a certain way and how we're going to build up and scale for a program, people are going to get a lot more value from that. So you don't need to be sore to have had a good workout. And I think that's the one that constantly comes up is that, oh, I'm not sore today, so then I didn't have a good session. Or I can't sit down to have a shit this morning, so I must have tanked my leg session yesterday. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be like that.
Sorry, just on that one as well. With the three mechanics for developing muscle hypertrophy, you've got mechanical tension,
muscular damage,
and metabolic stress. Muscular damage is probably the least important because when you think about it logically, if you are that sore, as in like you're so significantly sore because you're pushing to achieve soreness that you can't properly train and you can't properly progress, you're not going to achieve the same level of muscular hypertrophy, which is increasing muscle size. You're just not. So when people strive for it, it's like, it happens.
Again, though, we all fall for it. For example, the first time that I'm just thinking now because we're going to America in 3 weeks, the first time I went to America, I did the Tom Platz 2-hour leg workout before I went because I was like, I'm not going to be training legs properly for a while. No joke. This is no joke. The intensity of the DOMS from the day after until day 7 when I was on the holiday did not ease up. I thought I was going to have to get a wheelchair or a buggy because I couldn't fucking walk just because I did like 16 sets of squats, 14 sets of leg extensions, and 14 sets of hamstring curls, then 10 sets of lunges. I was there for 2 hours. I was, no joke, when I was walking home, I didn't know whether I'd left planet Earth because my head just wasn't there.
But that's the thing though. I mean, even now, we still occasionally will be sore. We will have DOMS, but it's not something that I'm like, really want to be sore. Yeah. I really don't want to be sore at the moment because I'm thinking, fucking hell, he's going to run a 40K.
Yeah, I'm the same because I'm doing a lot of bike at the moment, doing a lot of running. My intention when I'm in the gym is I'll usually try not to be sore the next day. So I'm not going to that level of failure where I'm literally crippled into the ground. I'm saving a rep maybe.
Yeah. It's crazy. That's a really good myth.
The other big one, and Cal sent me this today, was there's a lot of myths that go on about around metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
Boost your metabolism with this bullshit. Boost your metabolism with this. Raise your metabolism doing this. And it's not so much a myth, but I suppose it is kind of a myth now. There's this new study that's just came out in the Journal of Science, literally just, I think it was this week. And it's found that a lot of people, as they age, you get that sort of terminology of, oh, those jeans that used to fit me, I can't get them anymore. Like, I'm not the age I used to be, because it was always thought that as you age, your metabolism drops down. So your output of energy and calories is way less. So it's easier for you to put on weight as you age.
Mm.
And that's always been the science. However, this new study has been looking at people's metabolisms and how they slow down. So what they found was that as you get older, metabolism doesn't slow down.
Let me explain. Is there a limit?
It does slow down, so let me explain that properly. So they actually found your metabolism does not slow as quick as we think. So from birth to 1 year old, you are like a metabolic machine. You could eat, you could do the 10K calorie challenge and be like, oh, what the fuck is that?
Yeah. You're like the baby out of Incredibles.
Yeah, falls out your ass, don't put a pound on because you're just a metabolic machine. And then it slows down after that about 3% a year. Okay. Until the age of around your teenagers or just before you're 20. So 3% every year. But then between the age of 20 to 60, it stays the same. And they were the years that people were looking at as in, well, this is the reason for, well, this is a big part of the obesity epidemic is because people's metabolic rate between those ages does slow down. This is why we get that mid-age weight. It was even shown that it doesn't stay the same through like things of like menopause and certain areas like that, whereas it was always thought that people's metabolic rate would slow down a lot during menopause, and it's been found that it stays the same.
That's really interesting.
But then post 60 years old, it does start slowing down again.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. So in a way...
basically, stop blaming your metabolism.
Yeah. In a way, people have naturally probably been like, because I'm 50, my metabolism is slower.
Yeah.
So it's not... kind of people have been using it as like a reasoning not to do something.
Yeah.
Study excuse. Means you can't do that anymore.
But this is the first study they've done on it. Is this the be all and end all of it? I don't know. This is one of the recent studies that's come out from the Journal of Science as well, so it's quite credible.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. I love that question. That was a really good question. I enjoyed that one. Shall I do my final question?
Fire your finale.
Okay. This was more of a statement. I kind of turned it into a little bit of a question. Every time I feel like I'm good at what I do, something happens to make me think otherwise. How can I believe in myself more?
I love that question.
Yeah, I think it's really nice. It's about self.
Just repeat that again, sorry.
Every time I feel like I'm good at what I do, something happens to make me think otherwise. How can I believe in myself more?
I would firstly try and address that thing that's making you create self-doubt. Mm. What is the thing that's making you feel like you're not good enough? Is it something that you're comparing yourself to? Is it a failure? Is it... that you didn't have a good week as you did last week. All those kind of things of one comparison, we all know that that's the thief of joy and that can be a massive deteriorating factor. If it's because you've had a bad week, we all have bad weeks. You can't operate with your foot down on the pedal every single week. There's going to be weeks like we're speaking about deload, you have to pull back a little bit. You're not always going to be at 100%.
Yeah.
So, sorry, what, there was the end of it. How to get more self-belief?
Just, yeah, in terms of how can I believe in myself more? So having more... self-belief behind, well, this person's obviously saying every time I feel like I'm good at what I do, so they do believe they're good at something, but then something might happen and then they have like a plunge in like their own self-confidence.
I think that comes down to a lot of time, and I sometimes think this even with the job that we do is, and it always comes down to comparing to other people.
I think so too.
I think it's a massive factor of that you don't believe that other people have negative thoughts or that other people have bad weeks. I have bad weeks sometimes where I just self-doubt myself sometimes. I'm like, I'm shit at what I do. I think realizing, I think the big thing, have relatability. This, us answering this question will probably help that person because me and Lucy both have weeks where we don't feel the best. We don't always feel great, superhuman, like we're helping the world. We have weeks where we're like, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? Like, are we even helping? Like, am I a fraud? Those kind of things creep into your head. Being self-aware of those and where those are coming from is massively helpful in your bid to be more self-confident, because as soon as you can address those and realize that's not me saying that, because our mind and our brain are two different things. Mm-hmm. I think it was a guy called Mo was on Stephen's podcast the other week. And it's often like we'll get those thoughts that come into our head of, you're shit at this, you're terrible at this.
Yeah.
They're not you thinking that. Because if we had control over our conscience all the time, we wouldn't let tell us things like that, would we? We would never let tell ourselves things like that.
Yeah, you'd never say it to a friend either. Like, yeah. You'd never say it to someone else.
It just goes to show that we don't always have control over our thoughts and what our mind's saying to us. And the brain and the mind can be two different things, because you would never tell yourself that because you don't want to feel that. You don't actually think that about yourself. As that person just alluded to, they know they're good at it. Yeah. There's only those thoughts of self-doubt. And once you're self-aware of those, you can say, fuck off.
Yeah, fuck off, see you later.
You don't need to listen to those thoughts.
Yeah.
And know that. Accept that you're allowed to feel bad or have bad weeks. I think the more that you push back against those feelings of I've got to be perfect all the time, those perfectionism thoughts, is when you have those self-doubt. Accepting the way that you feel sometimes in that moment can be very, very helpful for moving on from it instead of trying to deny it.
Yeah, that was really, it was perfectly written. That should be
spoken.
I think one of the things that you picked up on really like significantly was the comparing to other people. I think your self-belief can be a bit deteriorated, or you don't feel that confident in yourself when you start looking at other people and what other people are doing in your space. And by your space, I mean your industry you're working in. This could be fashion, fitness, travel, business, whatever it is. You start comparing to other people and you think they have expectations for you. And yeah, in lines of work, you have expectations to meet at work, but then you put so much external pressure on yourself to be perfect all the time. When something doesn't go to plan, you instantly think you aren't good at it. It's not that you aren't good at it. You've just been met with something that's a little bit more complicated, like a failure or, I don't know, a project that just didn't go to plan, but you're supposed to fail. You have to fail in life to be able to experience different things and actually experience those emotions. And then it's like, oh, I need to trust myself. Like, shit happens. Like, trusting in yourself and knowing you've literally fucked up. But then, okay, how can I learn from it? I think that gives you a lot of self-confidence, because I think if you go in with the mindset of, I'm never going to fail, boom, 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 you're not going to deal with when you do fail, and it will happen. You will fail at something. Could even relate it to the gym. You're probably going to fail a squat at some point. Don't let it set you back so hard that you can't essentially move forward from that.
Yeah, I think those short terms are important, because I said this before, when you have days or issues like that where something doesn't go to plan, try and look at it with a telescope rather than a magnifying glass. Because what people will do, for example, if we had someone who's the world's strongest man at the moment, Tom Stoltman. Say if he had a training day where he failed a lift, it doesn't mean that he's never going to hit that lift again, or he hasn't hit that lift before. It's just that one day.
Yeah.
And you've had those days where you come in from running and you've had a shit day of running, or you felt crap and you're like, oh, I feel shit, I was terrible. That was not a good run. I didn't feel great from it. It's just one day. Yeah. And in the grand scheme of things, if you're in the middle of a program, or if you're doing something, or if you've got a goal that you're looking to achieve, having one bad day in the midst of all that is like a drop in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And if you focus so much on that one day rather than having perspective and standing back a little bit, it's going to create a mindset where you are just toxic with yourself and have those negative self-thoughts rather than, yeah, it was one day. It's one bad training day. It was one bad day for whatever. It was one bad day in my progress of the goal that I'm trying to achieve. And tomorrow's a new day.
Yeah. Mic drop. Mic hit. Our mics, if you aren't subscribed to YouTube, do that right now. You'll see our bougie set where our mics are literally floating.
Do you know what? I've started to watch a lot more podcasts now. I don't listen to as many as I used to. It's something just about watching people's body language and stuff.
Yeah.
So I watch on YouTube. The
finale.
Third and final question. I've wrote a couple of notes on this one. So if you want to ask any questions on it, then please.
Why are you about to throw me off? Do I need to?
Well, it's a question which is quite specific.
Okay.
So it was thoughts on the new report on branded cereals containing more than double the amount of sugar than own brands, the supermarket own brands.
That's really interesting. How much sugar, sorry? Or just so, like,
okay, I'll tell you some of the,
more.
I'll tell you some of the stats first.
Hit me
as well.
Some stats.
If you have anything on it, Cal, as well, that you look at, then let me know. So what I found was, when I was having a little dig around into it, is that a lot of like the Kellogg's, the Nestle's type of cereals, when we compare them to the supermarket's own brands, are double or more than double in sugar content, but still similar calorie content.
Mm-hmm.
So the sugar's way higher, and also the salt is like three times higher in them as well. The other thing that's three times higher is the cost per box. So for example, if you have Kellogg's Frosties per box, they are £3.30. Tesco's, Asda, Sainsbury's are all a pound. You've got Aldi, which is 99p.
So one of the cereals that I absolutely caned in when I was little, do you remember Sugar Puffs?
Yeah.
They're called something else now. They've taken the word sugar out the title. Per serving, and the serving size is what? Is it 30 grams for cereal usually?
30 grams, yeah.
19.6 grams of sugar. Per 30 gram serving.
Well, Cal, I'll get you to put this little screenshot on screen of what I'm looking at now, because it's a kind of span of the cereals across of Kellogg's, Nestle, Jordan's, granola, even Kellogg Crunchy Nut, what you had yesterday was on there, Luce. That was 9.3 grams of sugar per 30 gram serving.
What about if you ate the whole bag, which is actually...
Well, you had about 60 grams, didn't you? That's the thing as well. So, for example, the Kellogg's Frosties, they're 11 grams of sugar. And the from what I was looking at on the NHS website, the recommended is between like 25 to 30 grams of free sugars per day, which is about the equivalent of 7 sugar cubes. So if no one's having 30 grams while they're on a sitting, everyone's having about 50 to 60, because unless you're a fucking mouse or a 10-year-old child, you're not having 30 grams. So you're probably 20 grams of sugar in a bowl of cereal in the morning.
I think one of the things as well, children aged 4 to 6 should have no more than 19 grams of free sugars a day, which is like 5 sugar cubes. You have your tiny 30-gram bowl serving of sugar puffs and you've hit it. 19 grams, you've already hit it, which I think, going back to when we were speaking about that 40% of children leave primary school obese, your cereal in the morning could actually be having quite a significant effect, because you don't have 30-gram servings. 30 grams is, 30 grams is like tiny, isn't it?
What did you say that stat was while kids?
Which, the obesity one? Yeah. 40% of children leave primary school obese or overweight.
Well, did you know 1 in 7 are obese by the time they start reception?
Yeah, that's...
compared to 1 in 10 before COVID struck.
So it's gone down since COVID?
It's worse.
Oh, it's worse. Yeah. Oh, okay. Sorry. Yeah. 1 in 7.
Yeah.
But, I can't remember your question.
Well,
you
it's about
me.
The cereal, isn't it? But a couple of things that has happened. Obviously, they've brought that calorie on foods, which doesn't really change much for this, because the calorie's always been foods. Mm-hmm. But they've had that traffic light system, which is like red, green, yellow, which talks about sugar content and calories and stuff. Because the thing is, when people are looking at things and calories are king, calories are king for when it comes to weight loss. But the other thing we've got to think about is like diabetes and stuff like that for, mm-hmm. for kids. And we all know that sugar is hyper palatable food. So kids are going to crave sugar and stuff more and want more of it. I think the Prime Minister also announced in 2020 that they were going to do more cracking down on child obesity because of how many were overweight, essentially. And part of that plan was that there's going to be new laws restricting offers on foods in high in fat, sugar and salt due to come into effect in large stores, I think, in October. So junk food giants will also be banned from advertising online after 9 p.m. from January 2023. So that was a big thing to try and tackle it.
And there's obviously... Oh, go on. I thought Carl was going to say something.
I thought he was.
You stumped me off then.
No, but...
So with the cereal thing as well, and the reason why this is probably so heavily in the media and is spoken about is because it is kind of like a global issue in a way to kind of tackle it. And we're categorically not saying cut out sugar, because you shouldn't do that. You should be having a balanced diet. However, if one of your main categories of food groups is sugar, that actually isn't... nutritionally, that isn't good for you.
We're not trying to put people off sugar, by the way, because I think the thing is, me and Carl discussion before, when we were in Lanzarote, Carl was banging cereal like left, right and centre every morning.
Golden Graham's sugar?
These like Spanish ones that are, I'm not even joking, they're like chocolate biscuits. Yeah, did you ever try them?
Yeah, they're insane. It was like breaking up chocolate digestive biscuits and pouring milk on them.
Yeah, literally nailing them.
Mm.
But you can do that. We're not like everyone fucking... I love cereal, by the way. I love cereal when I go to those hotel breakfasts and stuff like that.
Like granola last night.
Yeah, I love cereal. Ooh. I'm just saying, don't be a wanker about it. Like, don't be having cereal every meal. Have cereal in the morning, even if it's like 10 to 15 grams of sugar. It just means that you don't have as much sugar later on in the day. It's not fucking hard. Yeah. Just be balanced. Have balance of stuff. The interesting thing comes in, though, is when we're looking at why does the branded cereals have double the amount of sugar of the, as the Tesco Sainsbury's own?
I honestly could not answer that question, because it doesn't make sense to me. Is it a cost thing? Does Kellogg's have triple the amount of cost to put into cereal because it's their sole product, whereas Tesco products, they have a huge range, so they're putting more money into a different variety of products, not just cereal. That's like the only thing I could think where they have such a wide variety of products. Like Tesco have their own rice. Kellogg's don't have their own rice. That's the only thing I could think of.
There's been a lot of backlash to branded cereal because they're just saying like how massively unnecessary it is and how grossly irresponsible it is for them to do that. And like what's the pet? Like all manufacturers have the same ingredients available. So why do they put so much sugar in. It's interesting because Carl was saying the other day when he used to work in a restaurant, one of the ways that they were like, oh, how can we make the food better? They just pour a shit ton more cream in it to taste better. We're obviously doing the same thing with that, just to make it more satiating, which is crazy. But the other thing which is mad is because when I was a kid, my dad had never let me have Cocoa Pops. One of the Kellogg cereals which had the least amount of sugars was Cocoa Pops, 5.1 grams per serving.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you want to know what I had? And this was my go-to. Was it Ready Breck?
I nearly bought that this morning, by
Ready
the way.
Ready Breck. Has, you can tell I've come from like a sport family. Has 0.5 grams of sugar.
Well, yeah. Cheerios is really good as well.
Ready Breck is the one. You can add like chocolate powder and make it like chocolate Ready Breck. Weetabix. Those other big things that look like a sack of hay. What are the ones that look like a big round of hay?
Shredded wheat.
Shredded wheat is phenomenal. Shredded wheat. Shreddies. Great. Oh, wow. I'm really going on cereal frenzy now.
There's this thing as well. There's a lot of talk, isn't there, about... And this is another myth, like how sugar is like a drug. It's so addictive. It's like a drug. It's fucking not. I mean, there's been some research just showing that sugars can be super stimulating to certain pathways in the brain that are associated to similar feelings of pleasure and reward. But they're not the same as like substance abuse, and doesn't make them as addictive as drugs either.
I think that's quite an unhealthy comparison to also compare.
Yeah, it's not the same.
Compare those two. So let's just snap that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of people who really bash sugar as well. Like, I lost fucking 20 pounds.
You didn't cut out calories.
You cut out a big portion of calories. If you cut out dairy, if you cut out carbohydrates, if you cut out like any big major food source of your day, especially if you're a gluttonous person who just feeds off fucking, I don't know, what's a really popular sweet, Skittles and sour gummies or whatever, and you cut that out, it's a big chunk of calories out your day which is gone. So
just to make a side note, I've actually just looked at, because I'm actually using MyFitnessPal at the moment to make sure I eat enough calories, because I am struggling eating ridiculous amounts for my training, so I'm making sure that I hit a lot. My sugar is actually like triple the amount it should be, but I have a lot of fruit. Sugar from fruit, sorry, is called fructose, but I have 60 grams of sugar, but that's including like two bananas and two apples and strawberries.
Yeah, so you gotta be careful when we're talking about the different types of sugars.
Yeah, so just to make note there, like that's not me having...
Yeah, because there's people who talk about apples and eating fruit is bad for you. It just pissed me off.
It's literally just fructose. I'm not saying like I eat teaspoons of white sugar to hit that, but that is actually important to know because people would look at it and be like, oh my God, I have so much. But if you're having an apple, how much actually? That's a super interesting one. Apple fructose number.
Well, sugar is one of those food groups that you actually don't need.
7.6.
What is?
Apple. Unpeeled apple. Fructose is 7.6 grams.
Yeah.
There you go.
Don't be scared of sugars, by the way.
Not at all.
Just eat them. I don't measure sugar.
No,
just,
I don't.
The more thing that was interesting to me is why the branded cereals would over double the amount of the, as in Tesco's own stuff. Obviously, they're being a bit more responsible than that. You can have a shitload. No, you can't have a shitload more because the calories are similar. But like, again, eat your cereal in the morning. Enjoy it. Don't be scared about boffins putting you off from having sugar. Just be balanced with whatever you're having later on in the day.
Yeah, 100%. That was a really great question, actually. Yeah. I've never even thought about, maybe they just put, you know, like with certain like companies, they put like dye or like more additives in it to make it look more colourful. But then again, cereal's like brown. Well, like, they're not making it look that colourful. I was just thinking, like, how are they doing it? Like, how are they doing it?
Oh, God knows.
Because you were so right. It all comes from the same factories, pretty much.
Yeah.
Rice Krispie comes from one to the other. I cannot answer it. And I'm very curious.
Yeah. It's obviously all Kellogg's and Nestle's as well. But Nestle said that a spokesperson said they removed 59 million teaspoons of sugar and 3 million teaspoons of salt from products over the last decade. I mean, is that really, it sounds like a lot, but then when you say over 10 years, is that really a lot?
How much was it?
59 million teaspoons of sugar.
Over 10 years.
Yeah.
They've really tried to lengthen that out, haven't they? By also saying a decade and 10 years.
But both multigrain Cheerios and Cookie Crisps are classified as non-high fat, sugar and salt, and have the amber label on the packaging according to UK government nutrition profile model.
I do actually think, you know, that label system, that's actually probably quite beneficial for people because not a lot of people, and they shouldn't feel the need to go on the back of a packet and always look at the calories.
Yeah.
If you are trying to eat more intuitively, you know, just enjoy food like as it is, but then also be quite mindful to be able to just see a colour.
Yeah.
I think that's actually probably quite a good initiative that they've brought out, even for like kids who are like 10 years plus, to be like, oh, look, it's green and amber.
Yeah. The other thing to be careful of is don't just base a food off like a single ingredient.
Oh, yeah.
Just because like it's a bit higher in sugar than other stuff, don't be put off by it. It's again just balancing things out, because if you look at, is it Jordan's granola? Oh my God, that's actually deemed as high sugar by the regulators. Because it's granola. Like, yeah. Granola can be quite high sugary, but...
I like muesli.
Yeah, just don't get too caught up on it. But I'd imagine, like, a lot of people are looking at this and more so thinking for the kids and stuff as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And
definitely.
More so thinking from a perspective of diabetes, not potentially weight loss.
Yeah,
100%. Just a quick one, guys. Do you know where this whole notion of, like, breakfast is the most important meal of the day?
Yeah.
Do you know where that came from?
Kellogg's.
Yeah. I've just been looking into it. Yeah,
Kellogg's slogan.
Yeah.
How crazy.
I wonder why they said that. One of the biggest breakfast companies in the world.
It's actually really good how they have managed to almost create that as a social norm. As in, yeah. Like the brand and the slogan was so powerful that it's just repeated by every single person, your mum, your dad, your gran, your granddad. Breakfast, most important meal of the day. Well, it's not for me because I fucking fast, mate.
Yeah, breakfast actually means breaking the fast.
Yeah.
And imagine if we still called it, what are you having for breaking the fast? Yeah. what is for...
Sure, mate, you're not
yeah.
there.
So yeah, it has been intertwined into one word. Super interesting, actually. Yeah. But there are all our questions. I love that episode. That was phenomenal.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good episode. I'm not going to say what next week's episode is, but it's a super exciting one.
Do what is it?
Don't want to say what it is. I'm not going to tell you. I'll tell you off air.
I know what it is.
It's the guest podcast next week.
I don't feel like I've been told, so this is exciting.
Oh, am I got in the wrong way?
I've already recorded it.
Yeah, it's already been pre-recorded.
Oh.
Yeah. So make sure that you tune in for that one. Super exciting guest. Really, really cool.
And just on that note as well, we massively appreciate it when you
tell
leave
them our massive mezzy bro
when you leave reviews on the podcast. So if you go on iTunes or Spotify, I don't know 100% how it works on Spotify, but if you go on Apple Podcasts, type in the Not So Fit Couple, tap 5 stars, I mean, or 4, but I mean, would definitely recommend 5, and then just write a little review. It just means so much to us.
Can I just say this, by the way, and I don't like to bang on about it, or people, the review we got about eating was from the Zach Bitter episode. No one ate a thing on the Zach Bitter episode.
How do you know it was for that one?
Because it said when you've got guests on, like a guest of that caliber who's agreed to come on and do the podcast, you shouldn't be rude and eat. No one ate.
We didn't even have Koro. Didn't have anything.
Anyway, yeah. Leave a good review. Also, check out the app because it's sick.
Yeah, Not So Fit 20.
And also, if you want to try one of these Air Up bottles that I'm currently showing you on screen.
Cheers.
You can get 10% off. Ooh. Link will be in the description, and use the Not So Fit for 10% discount.
Yeah. And as always, have a wonderful day or evening, and we will catch you in next week's episode. Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.